So that's all the preliminaries, but the really important thing is for me to introduce this year's speaker, Tony Gilligan, who is the psychotherapy training coordinator at the Gestalt Centre London, and has done that for many years. She's also a director of the centre, and also for many years. I think Tony began as a young social worker, and has been involved in Gestalt from about 1978. So she's a long-standing presence in our community. And also spent 13 years in the health service as a clinical psychologist. Before that, Tony ran a centre for those with alcohol problems. She's a founding member of UK AGP, an associate member of the New York Gestalt Institute, and just recently has been elected as President-elect of the Association for the Advancement of Gestalt Therapy, which is the international organization, and I'd like to congratulate you on that. But more to the point, I want to congratulate us on asking and receiving an acceptance from Tony to be our speaker this year. Tony is going to speak on the subject Beyond Who's to Blame, the Critique of Complaints Procedures. Tony Gilligan.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. I don't know when this should happen, but as the organising committee has stood, perhaps now we can say thank you very much for organising this for us and for taking such good care of me, and so to the organising committee. Okay, as I stand here, I'm reminding myself to say one thing at a time and not get carried away and try and do three things at a time. Is that right? When Malcolm asked me if I'd do this talk, I said yes, and that my interest is in the application of our theory. I don't just mean Gestalt therapy theory, but I'm starting from that place. To our political and social practices, how we order our relationships with each other. My interest in that arises from something like this. I think that we live in a time of competing anthropologies, wildly competing views over what it is to be human, what it is to be a person in our world. Very roughly speaking, we can describe one of those anthropologies as the modernist anthropology, which has held sway for about 300 years. Its assumptions are reductionist, dualist, and they result in a prevailing ethic of hyper-individualism. Exploitation. I couldn't understand why, as I was preparing for this lecture some months ago, I kept thinking about exploitation, and it became clear to me. It's almost as though the ethic of that particular anthropology is the legitimization and the, more than the legitimization, the endorsement of exploitation. In its apotheosis, is that the word? It's in Richard Dawkins' writings on the selfish gene. Reductionist, we're no more than our collection of genes, and dualist, our genes are what set us to be these greedy, competitive, selfish creatures. The alternative anthropology, which I imagine that most of you here will share, is an anthropology of humans as part of the world in which we live, of process, of being situated, incarnate, embodied, and inseparable from our world. A world which is one of us as complex wholes within other complex wholes, and our world as a complex whole. I'm distracted because I can see my computer. So part of my motivation in agreeing to do this talk is that I believe that we must do the work of taking our theory outside of the consulting room, the coaching office, the social work office, and into how we structure our relationships in work, in society, in politics. Now, let me just say, by we, I'm not simply talking about Gestalt therapy theorists. I don't know how many of you here are Gestalt therapy practitioners, but I'm using the we in the way that Donna Orange has used the we, the humanistic practitioners. I think the underlying assumptions of Gestalt therapy theory are shared with other humanistic practitioners, including many practitioners of complementary health approaches, by the intersubjective school that Donna Orange speaks of, and others, of course, intersubjective school of relational psychoanalysis, and by environmentalists. I believe that where the environmentalists have shown how a field view applies crucially to our world and its ecosystems, we have articulated and continue to articulate how that applies in human behaviour and relationships. But in large part, we are missing from the external debate. In researching for this talk, I read a number of books, followed various avenues, and I recognized so many of the ideas, field, figure ground, wholes and parts, process, embodiment, all of those things. But except for the occasional mention of Merleau-Ponty, there was no reference to any of the humanistic psychology, psychotherapy literature. None of Gestalt psychology, which was a key part of the evolution of a postmodern paradigm, let alone of Gestalt therapy. This work of taking our theories outside our immediate practices can be done, and it has been done. There's an excellent article in one of the books at the back there by a woman called Caroline Lukensmeyer, and her America Speaks. I recommend it to you. And there's other people working in organizations implicitly or explicitly use our theory, use the ideas arising from this paradigm. But I don't know if this is a good analogy, but like indie performers, we haven't yet had our crossover album. We haven't yet had any significant impact in the writing and talking of these ideas outside of our own world, despite some really inspiring and lucid and hugely relevant writings by people like Philip Lichtenberg, Gordon Wheeler, Judith Heming, Malcolm here. To the extent that we don't attempt to put our theory and our paradigm into political, social, and our community practices, if we continue to allow our lives and order our lives in accordance with the modernist view, then we are complicit with it. So that was my starting point. The second thing is, well, yes, but okay, why complaints procedures? Well, came out of my mouth, but of course it didn't come out of my mouth without some ground. But before I speak of that, so that we mobilize the expertise in this room, would you please, in small groups, which is probably half a table, turn and talk to each other for 3 or 4 minutes. Just speak out the words, experiences, images, metaphors that bubble up in your awareness when I say words like complaints, complaints procedures. Would you do that now, please? No need to explain or give the whole story behind it. Just let it surface to your awareness. Okay. Thank you. If you want to call any of those out into the room for us to hold generally, feel free to do that.
Fear.
Thank you.
Shame.
Thank you.
Yeah,
material. Paperwork. Thank you. Hypocrisy. Victimising.
A felt physical tension.
It was victimising and felt physical tension.
Shame.
Say again?
Excitement.
Thank you.
Very.
Okay, so it's present here, much of what I think I'm going to be talking about. So at the moment of suggesting complaints procedures, this is part of where I think that came from. I was under threat of a complaint at that time, and I spent so much time feeling the aura of that, the threat, the dread, shame, the fear. And that evoked previous instances of having been engaged in being complained against. I have friends, I'm thinking in particular of somebody who's in the medical profession, who was complained against. It was an awful, awful situation, and I firmly believe that the outcome in each, they got it wrong. A few years ago, Carl Hodges and I did some work trying to put into gestalt therapy theory notions of power. This was after the US-UK invasion of Afghanistan. We were feeling, like many of us here, hopeless in the face of that decision. One thing that we took up on was Wertheimer's wholes and parts. I'll refer back to that later. But one aspect of that is to ask myself the question, quite constantly, what is my part in this? The environmentalists, of course, are there already. They talk about thinking globally and acting locally. I'm reversing that slightly. I'm acting locally, what is the complaint event, and inviting us and myself to think more of a wider field. What's my part in that? And then, of course, at the end of her life, Marion Fry, in whose honour and memory these lectures are named, was subject to a complaint. I didn't know her. I never knew until very recently the details of that complaint. They were openly known amongst her Gestalt community. I have no idea to what extent the instigation of this lecture was in any way, consciously or unconsciously, a response to that. It certainly honours her. And as somebody outside of her immediate Gestalt community, I've always felt that it was a statement of standing by her. And I didn't think that I could mention, be talking about complaints without acknowledging that. And saying, and I'll come back to this, that I think some of what she wrote very briefly about our understanding of ethical breaches comes close to what I think I arrive at. Okay, so, just another little bit before I get down to the nitty-gritty. I put out an email invitation in a couple of Gestalt networks asking for people who would be willing to talk to me in confidence about their experience of being complained against or making a complaint, or in either case being under threat of being complained against or seriously considering making a complaint. I'm very grateful to the people who responded and spoke to me. I will refer to them throughout as my correspondents. And any quotes or paraphrases that I attribute to them during the course of this talk, I have cleared with them. I'm also grateful to my peer group, the in-service group. We've been meeting for over 25 years. And they supported me in clarifying some of my ideas early on in this process. And I've had conversations with Carl Hodges from New York, some of you will know him, Peter Phillipson, and Robin Sherrett. All of those have contributed to my thinking, though, as they say, these are my ideas. They're not responsible for them. And I think in some circumstances, they actively disagree with them. So I want to start with, I'm going to start with, the present situation. If you look at the code of practice of the UKCP, just a quarter. How many people here are counsellors or psychotherapists? Okay, so although I don't think that what I'm speaking of is confined to that. I will stop being too careful about always saying and others, since most of us here are councillors of some purposes. So if you look at the code of the UKCP, it's a 30-something long list of sentences, all of which start, the psychotherapist, ... and are followed by prescriptions and proscriptions, do's and don'ts, the psychotherapist won't. Only four of those refer to the therapeutic relationship, and again, those are prescriptions and proscriptions in relation to that. The BACP code, is more accessible, it's less tut-tut-tut when you first look at it. It starts from a list of values that, as practitioners, we aspire to, and goes from there to a list of principles, and then develops these into a list of slightly less finger-wagging exhortations and cautions. Now, I'm not saying that any of the behaviours that they describe I agree with them. I would agree that most are, at the very least, errors, and in the extreme case, profound violations of the trust that our clients place in us. So I'm not arguing with that. What I am pointing out is that they have a very, very individualistic focus. The practitioner... it is the next one. The practitioner as a separated individual. If we consider the complaints procedure, this is even more apparent. Both complaints procedures share the same structure and assumptions. They are adversarial, they're quasi-legal. The reality of one proponent, complainant, is pitched against the reality of the other, and the two realities are tested. And this presupposes these things. That reality is objectively knowable, and that a group of people, the panel, can arrive at that reality. This is what's called a correspondence truth. I'll come back to that. That the two proponents are separate individuals, and the events or behaviours complained of were done by one to the other out of any larger context. And that therefore one is right and the other wrong, and that this is a situation where blame can be located with an individual. I'll just pause for a moment. So that reality is objectively knowable, correspondence truth. Proponents are separate individuals outside of any context, a larger context, and blame can be located with one individual. These presuppositions are dualistic and reductionist. They depend on, they're resolutely part of, a modernist Cartesian and reductionist epistemology. And these are some of the key assumptions underlying those. So the basic Cartesian assumption is that, by the way, I'm not a trained philosopher. And in reading this, I realise that when we, humanistic psychologists and psychotherapists, talk about this, we sometimes simplify very complex philosophical ideas. But as workaday ideas, I think it's a good enough fit. The basic Cartesian assumption is that of the separation of mind and body, that the mind is somehow a different substance and outside of the body. Following from this are these sort of dualisms, that the subject, the perceiving, thinking mind, and the object, the perceived, other, external, whatever it is, person, animal, rocket ship. The other, so there's that division between subject and object, that they're separate and independent. That the other, the external, can be known from outside as an objective knowing. It's a knowing of its nature independently of our relationship with it. Just pausing. So this, along with reductionism, the idea that we understand how things work by breaking them into smaller and smaller parts, and that meaning gets lost in this, of course, but that meaning disappears and we only have cause and effect. I'm a human being because my genes make me do X, Y, Z. Thinking is this neuron firing, that neuron firing. That reductionist attitude leads to a number of assumptions which are embedded deeply in our Western culture and which inevitably form and shape our codes and practices, even when we consciously disavow them. Think about how difficult it is not to think in terms of right or wrong, not to think in terms of, oh, well, it's human nature. So some of these assumptions are the individual as separate from other individuals, the individual as an entity, reality, as I said, objectively knowable, stuff, what our world is made up of smaller building blocks. Explanation, therefore, is causal, which is different from understanding or meaning. Truth as correspondence. The correspondence theory of truth accounts for truth as a proposition that says there is an external event, feature, whatever it is, in the world, and my passive reception of that and proposition about that directly corresponds to it. So there is a fact, and what I say, the proposition that red is red, is a fact. So there's a single true version of any particular external event. And therefore, there's discernible, accurate, objective, right and wrong. And just to remind us of the individualism, the extreme individualism inherent in all of that, with Richard Dawkins' selfish gene. So the UKCP Code of Practice, with its lists of do's and don'ts, conveys the sense of a profession rife with abuse, exploitation, and the need for constant policing, exhortation to do better, and guarding against human nature's natural nature. The need for the client to be constantly protected from exploitation. And actually, this is very far from the truth. You'll know that from your own practices. But I spoke with somebody at UKCP Complaints, and they said that the very, very small number of complaints come their way. 0.04% people complaining, 0.04% as a percentage of the number of practitioners. And that this is, they called it an industry standard, which tickled me, but I take the industry to be counselling, psychotherapy, medicine, maybe social work in that. So we've got very, very few cases that come, very few situations that come to that, to what the code seemed to have been written to prevent. And then there's shaming. There's the shaming of the therapist or the counsellor in the publication of details of the hearings, sanctions, etc. Now, I'm sure that if someone is judged not fit to practice, that needs to be in the public domain. There needs to be a notice somewhere that says such and such person has been removed from the register, either temporarily or permanently. But I don't honestly see the need for details of accusations or details of proceedings that don't result in removal to be made public. Why do I need to know that so-and-so is having extra supervision, more therapy, is going to write a self-objective report to show what they've learned? I don't need to know that. The people who do need to know, the community within which transparency is important, already do know. The practitioner, their client, practitioner, supervisor, peer group if they belong to that group, workplace if it's a workplace issue, and certainly the client's friends and network. It's not a secret, but I don't see why it should be broadcast as widely as it is. And I don't know if any of you have done this, but in researching for this, I looked at the UKCP register and the UKCP website. You get to a certain page and upscroll these names from 2007. I don't need to know it. It's as though we as a profession have caught the appetite or bought the story, the proposition that's present in the public mood of naming and shaming. As though that is the way that we ought to police people's behaviour. And we ought to know better. We know that shame produces withdrawal, it produces defensiveness, and we know that shaming does not support growth or learning, or as Robert Lee in his book Values and Connections shows very clearly, it doesn't support health-supporting fields. I don't mean green ones, you know what I mean by fields. What it does do is place blame on the individual, allocating blame to an individual, and it relieves the rest of us of any need to consider what our part in that event might have been. We can be taken by sympathy for the person, we can be wired to be interested, but we're not asking ourselves, what was my part in that? Blaming an individual, as I'm pointing out, is clearly part of the modernist paradigm, and of the view of people as essentially selfish and needing strong social disapprobation to be kept in line. Okay, I'm going to put some flesh on this a little bit and then take a pause of breath. So if we put flesh on it, I will come back to examine those assumptions a bit later. But I want to share with you what some of my correspondents said. In most of my correspondents' description of their experience of complaints procedures, there was a pervading feeling of shame and fear and dread, and when making a complaint, a feeling of wanting to be heard. One correspondent spoke of how, despite knowing very clearly that the complaint against them had no basis, how scared they felt, got at, paranoid. They wondered if it would ruin their career. Two correspondents had extensive experience of managing complaints procedures. They say, therapists feel so much shame, they've got it wrong for the client. People know they would never intentionally hurt anyone, a lot of shame. And first reaction to receiving a complaint is a sense of absolute dread, and then trying to keep some perspective on what it's about, trying to help people not to panic. And because we seem to be living in litigious times, find it hard to get away from a legalistic framework. That's unfortunate. Don't know if it would ever be acceptable for it to be other than that, not just for clients, but for therapists. Therapists have this dread of being unmasked. Making these legislative frameworks is one way of making ourselves feel less anxious, but don't think it works. Correspondent speaking of a complaint against them. I couldn't say that I did do some of it wrong. Preferable to be operating in a climate where I could have been open, feeling, knowing myself to be behaving in a way that was defensive. I'd love it if we could create a climate where I don't have to be defensive. And similarly, but this time the correspondent was making the complaint, thinking of when I made a complaint, I know what I really would have liked would have been to have had some dialogue, and that didn't seem possible. And similarly, this correspondent complained against, while knowing the complaint was unsupportable, understood what the fit was, what had caused the client to want to complain. My correspondent felt the response of the agency was perfectly proper procedure and also very supportive to my correspondent. Closed it down. They would have preferred a middle way where the complainant felt listened to. So despite friends and supervisors and other sources of support, it often seems to be an isolating experience for both parties, with shame and defensiveness on one side and a frustrated desire to be fully heard on the other. And crucially, it ends the relationship, ends the therapeutic relationship. Pause for breath. Take some time to talk with each other, chew what I've said a little bit. I'll give a few moments after that for you to ask me clarifying questions, not debating questions. We get to that at the end. How are you doing? Yeah? Have a chat. Sorry. Here we go. At the end of me talking, I'll take questions and debate, lovely in that. And then in the afternoon, we'll do something together to tease this out practically, experientially. For now, so what is this thing called postmodernism? Well, as you won't be surprised to find, in researching this, I discovered that there is no undisputed definition of it. It's a handy label, but it's not a very precise one. Nevertheless, I think that there are certain cohering ideas that form part of it, particularly in relation to the work that we do. David Bohm, who's a theoretical physicist, who was a theoretical physicist from the mid-20th century, who, interestingly, he wrote a book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order, which clearly is a postmodernist thing forming and flux. He reminds us that the word theory comes from the same roots as the word theatre, Greek roots, I think, and means a way of seeing. Our theories are a way of seeing. And scientific theories, as Brian Goodwin demonstrates very nicely, are not exempt from being ways of knowing, and therefore within a context. But theories are simply a way of knowing, a way of seeing. And the modernist way of seeing has been remarkably successful in lots of different ways, principally through science, but also in the beginnings of some sense of people as individuals with individual rights. However, it has led to, a dire threat, not just to our environment in the way that we'll be familiar with in terms of the environmental disaster that's awaiting us, but also in something to do with how we organize ourselves in relation to each other. Whilst I think somebody has said that this is the longest period of peace that we've known for however long, it's very difficult to believe that when we think about what's happening in Syria, Iraq, various other places of the world. So, whilst for many areas of life it remains useful and practical, it's not something that is a really accurate or helpful way of seeing an awful lot of things to do with us as human relations, human relationships. Now, it's not easy to do this linearly, because as you might suppose, a postmodern epistemology, you can enter it from various different places. I'm going to do it under three headings. Don't think of those as separate headings. It's very difficult to speak of one without invoking the other. But just to lay it out, I'm going to do it this way. So from phenomenology, from hermeneutic phenomenology, hermeneutics, the study of interpretations, from physics, from gestalt psychology, from elsewhere in science like biology, and certainly from the arts, we know that there is no independent knowing. We know that the idea of an observer untouched by and uninfluencing of their observation is a myth. It's a simplifying and perhaps comforting myth, but it's nevertheless a myth. We are an interpretive species. I cannot know except through my means of knowing. I cannot get away from my viewpoint, literally as well as metaphorically, from my perspective. I can see from no other perspective but mine. I can experience from no other perspective but mine. We interpret, that's the basis of phenomenological analysis, and the basis of our interpretations, our intentional constructs, our beliefs, our sedimented constructs in Merleau-Ponty's term, our prejudgments in Gadamer's term, and prejudgments, these arise from, are formed by our context. We learn them from being situated in our contexts. Our situatedness, remember, is incarnate, it's embodied. The mind-body dualism doesn't hold. The task then becomes the search for meaning and understanding through revealing the layers of contextual interpretation. Those of you who are familiar with intersectionality, from the black feminist writers, but it's coming to the same area. So I'll say it again, I'm always a situated interpreter. I cannot, therefore, claim to know the other, only my interpretations of the other. And these arise from my perspective, my prejudgments. There is no context-less knowing, meaning, or understanding. Yeah? This is Gadamer, whom I've only just relatively recently introduced, but I think he's great. He's a phenomenologist and a student of Heidegger. So Donna Orange says that Gadamer's hermeneutics, the study of meaning and interpretation, he developed into a whole philosophy of understanding emergent in dialogue. And wherever I read about this, the words emergent in dialogue kept coming up and coming up from different angles, from different starting points. Okay, the second heading I'll put this under is the primacy of relationship. That we now know that matter, stuff, things, organisms, my perceptual world, my phenomenal world, are better understood in terms of relationships of process, of form, temporary forms, processes and extension, forming and reforming relationships. And that includes us. That's the fundamental statement of Carl Sevelin and Goodman, contact is the first reality. And we're still working to take that seriously. Contact is the first reality. And Lynn Jacobs puts it, we have no experience that is prior to relatedness. Did I write that up? So Lynn Jacobs frames it, we have no experience that is prior to relatedness. So our phenomenal worlds, our experienced worlds, are interpreted, they're co-created, co-emergent with the other. We have no experience prior to relatedness. My experience of myself is at and of the same time the experience of you. So they're co-emergent with the other. Both are non-human world and human world. The world of relationship, the world of you and I. You'll know this from a number of, you'll know this from Buber, you'll know this from phenomenology, etc. So you and I co-form each other in meeting. Actually, our co-forming is meeting. We don't meet as two individuals and somehow come together. We're profoundly and originally implicated with each other. And of course, one aspect of that is self as process. Self is experiential and it's a process. The third heading I put this lot under is that fields are complex and self-organizing. So the fields that we talk about, when we talk in field theoretical terms, we're talking about complex, self-organizing fields. And this organizing takes the form of wholes and parts. Goldstein said it, Wertheimer says it, but I discovered that Spinoza, somebody way back in the 13th century was saying it, that things cannot be understood outside of the whole of which they form a part. Brian Goodwin says that the forms that arise from self-organizing, it's now recognized, are very widespread in nature, particularly in living systems. It's not just our experiential phenomenal world that has this, or our very mechanistic biological world. It seems to be a rhythm of nature. It's a dynamic of nature, particularly living systems. And Mary Midgley, when she's refuting Dawkins' selfish gene, says about self-organization, What needs to be the next business of evolutionists is to understand the workings of self-organisation. And of course, Gestalt, in Gestalt psychology, Wertheimer put it, the fundamental formula of Gestalt theory might be expressed in this way. There are wholes and parts, the behaviour of which is not determined by that of their individual elements, but where the part processes are themselves determined by the intrinsic nature of the whole. You must see the problem's dynamic functional relationship to the whole form from which it was lifted, or you will never understand it. You must see the problem in its dynamic functional relationship to the whole from which it's been lifted, or you'll never understand it. In other words, meaning cannot be reduced to something in its constituents. Okay, so where does this lead us? With complaints procedures. There are a number of framings of ethical principles that I came across from doing this reading. You'll find the one in Robert Lee's book, which sadly we don't have here, on values and connection. He says the key ethic that emanates from our theory is that we must find whole field solutions that support both self and environment, that support self-other development. And in the lead up to that, he says, healthy self-process occurs with low levels of ground shame. Low ground shame corresponds to enough perceived receptivity in the field, enough receptivity in a wide range of dimensions. Gordon Wheeler says, this is a complicated sentence, by ethics we mean any organized or systematic set of values. And by values, we mean a fairly ingrounded preference for a particular behaviour, even when, and particularly when, that behaviour goes against what might be seen as our natural inclinations or pleasure. So without regard for the immediate outcome of the behaviour or consideration for personal satisfaction, other than the resolution of the ethical gestalt, I'm not going to use the word hardwired, I don't like it, but we seem to have some embedded preferences to behave in ways that are ethical in the way we would understand the word. And interestingly, and if you're interested, I'll chat later about it, he's saying something very similar to what Darwin said. Darwin has been grossly misrepresented, or Darwinism has been grossly misrepresented. And Darwin says something very similar to what Gordon Wheeler has said about we are a social and therefore a moral species. Moral species. I think these all point both to dialogue but also to what's my part in it. I want to diverge a bit, this is not a divergence. I want to talk a little bit about the therapeutic relationship. And I'm grateful to this correspondent because I hadn't thought to include this in it, but this correspondent said, was very concerned about what they saw as the implications of a field approach to complaints. And this is part of what they said. Part of the field, when I see a client, is they come to see me as a member of a community with expectations that I've made commitments to ethical practice. It's the basis for our engagement and why they make themselves vulnerable. To do ethics in any particular way is very difficult. And sometimes we, thinking about our community, do it badly because it's based on something done behind closed doors, known only to the two participants. They went on that when doing ethics, especially about serious breaches, sexual exploitation, financial exploitation, the person will have done that or not have done that. It's not about whether there is a field aspect to it or not. They then say the code of ethics is part of the field between therapist and client. And that if a complaints panel is trying to follow some overarching field theory, they'd be playing a different game than the one that the client believes they've signed up for in their therapeutic frame. Whereas a setup that's managed as a quasi-judicial procedure stops that getting worse. Sorry. Now, I'm not sure I've properly understood what they meant by playing a different game or an overarching field theory. But it did lead me to think let me be clear, but I don't believe that any of what we would consider to be serious ethical breaches would not be considered serious ethical breaches under a postmodernist frame. And it remains the case that the therapeutic relationship is still that. It's a particular kind of relationship with an important differentiation of roles. Those roles co-emerge and co-form, as in our postmodernist view, but it's still a differentiation of roles in just the way that as you and I form, we are formed both from and of the field and the aspects of difference at that point of co-forming. So this differentiation includes the assumption by both parties that the therapist is there to support the client's development, that the therapist has the greater knowledge of what behaviour on the therapist's part, will support the client's development, and that the client may rely on the therapist to act in the best interest of the client and of the therapeutic relationship. Though I don't think anything I'm saying about postmodern, changes that. So that's the frame. And as a consequence of that, the client, as my correspondent says, the client is willing to make themselves vulnerable. In this way of looking at things, so must the therapist be willing to make themselves vulnerable. In the therapeutic conversation, I believe, it's the therapist who should take the lead in testing their prejudgments, their presuppositions, their perspective. We should ask ourselves in this co-creation, what am I doing that my client is seeing X, Y, or Z? My client feels suspicious of me, unable to talk to me, angry with me, wants to tell me this story. Not what is the client doing. There's no room in this for talking about clients projecting. That would privilege my interpretation over theirs. And this is a situation in which my interpretations are as fallible as their interpretations.
Can I just ask you, are you talking about within the context of the therapeutic relationship?
But I'm also talking about the context of other... bringing that into a complaints procedure,
right.
But I'm also talking about other conversations where misunderstandings arise. Yeah. Gadamer says, we try to transpose ourselves into the perspective within which he, the other, has formed his views. We try to understand how what he is saying could be right, and indeed does seem right to him. Lynn Jacobs, in her article, in her chapter, in this one, it might be, The Solitary Self, gives a lovely example of that. Okay. Now, I'm not sure this is the right order, but I'll do it in this right order. I think what I've come to believe as a result of doing this research, and what I'm proposing, is that most, if not all, ethical breaches are misunderstandings. Now that might seem too little a word for them, but I'm using the word misunderstanding in the way that phenomenologists use it, in the way that Gadamer uses it, in other words, that my perspective, my preconceptions, whatever language you want to use, about my prejudgments, are a mismatch for my clients, and obviously vice versa. We are talking at cross purposes. Now, I haven't done enough work to yet feel I can step all the way out and say major breaches are misunderstandings. I suspect that they are, but I would need to add more to justify that. But I believe that most ethical breaches are misunderstandings, as I say, in the phenomenological Gadamerian sense. What is more, not only are misunderstandings inevitable, successful therapy depends on misunderstandings. If we don't have misunderstandings, the therapy is one or other of us preaching our perspective to the other. So therapy, counselling, other difficult conversations, conversations where we're trying to sort something out, depend on misunderstandings in order to arrive at an understanding. That's Gadamer's phrase. Gadamer says, what is true then is an understanding emergent from the conversational interplay, and truth as emergent and self-correcting understanding. Truth as emergent and self-correcting understanding. Okay, I think that position is very close to my understanding of what Marion Fry wrote or said to Judith Heming in the interview that Judith had with her for the British Star Journal. That her belief was that what could be seen as ethical breaches were unconscious, unaware mistakes. And of course, that's what unaware mistake. When we speak of unawareness, we're speaking of those assumptions I don't know I hold, but nevertheless are forming my response, my orientation in this situation. And Marion, in that interview, spoke of ethical breaches being those kind of misunderstandings that led to, that were unconsciously present in the relationship, and that could lead to good therapy, but could be viewed as ethical breaches. All right, so from there, this is what I think, starting to put together a postmodernist complaints procedure. First of all, reality as objectively knowable, correspondence truth, is replaced by meaning as a coherence truth. Truth, in that way, is understood as a coherence between different views. Lynn Jacobs says, it's an experiential resonance, a felt rightness that rendered their differences, she's talking about a dyad, coherent to them. This is the coherence theory of truth. It's, oh, I've got it. I see where you're coming from. Coherence theories, there are a number of them, account for the truth of a proposition, this is true, as arising out of a relationship between that proposition and other propositions, not some objectively knowable fact. And so a community can arrive at coherence truths, at least temporarily, because in this view, of course, truth is an understanding, is part of an emergent process. I've already said this, what is true then, says Gadamer, is an understanding emergent from the conversational interplay. So that is through dialogue, continuing the conversation with full awareness of and commitment to understanding the other's perspective without holding in any way that my perspective is somehow more real or true. I'm as willing to question and lay bare my assumptions as the other. Secondly, the notion of the two proponents in the complaints procedure as separate individuals out of any larger context is replaced by the two proponents, co-creative, co-forming, and formed in the context situation of the therapy event as part of the wider field. I don't want to define what that wider field is. One of the things that this throws up. But that they cannot be seen as two separate individuals. They're part of a wider field. Quasi-legal, well, I was at a talk last weekend by Polly Higgins. Some of you will know Polly Higgins. She's the lawyer who's succeed in getting ecocide made the fifth international crime. And she said at the beginning of her talk that the original meaning of lawyer, she had discovered, was healing of the community's woes. In other words, we can be testing and challenging and scrutinizing without being adversarial. We can see the call to be all of those things as a, I don't know if I'd use the word healing, but as a call to be healing rather than as a call to support a fight. And again, of course, blame is located in the individual is replaced by blame is not located in the individual, it's, as I said previously, And shaming does not support the field. We need to do something to reduce the shame that's involved in all of this. Okay. What could this look like? I have no idea, to be truthful with you. But this is as far as I've got. Very tentatively and provisionally, I think it should consist of support for continuing the conversation wherever possible, and where it's not possible between the client and the therapist, for nevertheless the conversation to be continued in some other way, and some process that allows the mobilization of non-local effects, the wider field. And if I flesh this out with what my correspondents said, most of my correspondents spoke of the wish of complainants to be heard. One correspondent with an extensive experience of managing complaints procedures said, if the complainant feels taken care of during the initial process of beginning a complaint, then that is a species of resolution. They have to feel heard, have to have an accepting that what the client says is true for them. And so far, when this correspondent has succeeded in hearing in that way, this has led to complainants feeling satisfied enough to discontinue the action, although the relationship with the therapist has ended. By the same token, this correspondent says, the therapist, apart from having to scrutinize their work, also has to find some peace in terms of the experience of being accused and needing to be neither defensive nor uppity, which I took to mean pathologizing, blaming the client. In my experience, says this correspondent, so far, the work does not continue, often because the hurt is too great and has been taken away from possible resolution within the therapy by virtue of another person being brought into the dyad to condemn, if you like, one or the other. They wondered if it would ever work if a client feeling insulted or harmed in some way by the therapist could be heard by another therapist as a helpful listener other, maybe a senior therapist who helps the client and maybe the therapist through their stuck place. In Lee's book, Values and Connection, Fleshing It Out, there's a lovely account of a residential setting for adolescent boys. It's a last resort, it's a place of last resort. They're on their way to prison or whatever the equivalent is in America. And one thing stood out from this for me in relation to what this, was that if one member of the community offends another, hurts another, breaks a rule, does anything to harm the community, goes out and creates havoc in the large community, which of course is very difficult for the residential community, the response of the community is to move closer to the offender. Not to move away from, but to move closer to the offender, to enfold them in some way. It's not about not calling them to account or getting them to think about what they were doing, but the movement is towards, not away from. Okay, I'm nearly there. I didn't know that Robin was going to be here today. And I've titled this section of it is What's Love Got to Do with It? Because Robin is giving a talk also on complaints procedures on the 18th of October, which he's entitled What's Love Got to Do with This? I haven't mentioned anything about love or I'm a bit English in that way, but I do think if I truly want to work to get to know the other as they come from their perspective, and let myself be known in that way, that is a form of very particular intimacy. And supporting that intimacy has to be a great deal of care for myself and other in that process. And I could call that love, but certainly I call it intimacy and care. Ricoeur, I think that's the way you pronounce it, who's a philosopher, describes Gadamer's hermeneutics as the hermeneutics of compassion. That is, of walking with the other in their suffering, in their struggle, as compared to the hermeneutics of suspicion, where I try to get the other to see it from my perspective. without risking my prejudgment. Gadamer says there is no higher principle than this, holding oneself open to the conversation. And then I was going to finish with a long list of anticipating, well, it begs this question, it begs that question. I won't preempt that. Rather, I'll leave the last word to one of my correspondents in relation both to love and local effects. This correspondent spoke of their experience following being told that a client had made a complaint against them. Their initial response they described as panic and a physical response that they had never had before of a week of acid reflux. It happened that the correspondent was due to attend an experientially focused workshop within days of hearing this. On the journey to and at that workshop, they, in their words, did a lot of work and found they had moved to a new place, a more expansive place. I'm quoting, "Something shifted in me in terms of not being frightened by my client, seeing us both being held in a field context, both doing what we needed to do. With the wider view came a rush of love for my client and myself, knowing we were doing what we could, both doing the best in the circumstances." It later transpired that the client, who had a history of making complaints, wrote to the agency to say they wouldn't be pursuing the complaint, that they felt resolved. Now, some of that would have been the result of how the agency complained to, responded, the care with which they took to ensure that the client felt heard. However, I suggest it's also an expression of non-local effect. The client can have had no direct knowledge of the therapist's shift, and yet it seems to me that one somehow echoed the other. Thank you. Smaller groups first and come back to the larger groups. Yeah, move around. You've been sitting for a long time. Give yourselves a bit of fit and body boots if you want to. We can talk and stand.
Can you say something about what you're referring to as prejudgment? But the reason I'm asking that is because my sense is that I'm testing that all the time.
Your prejudgment?
My prejudgment as a therapist, and I'm testing that all the time with my client. And is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Because I know you were talking about, well, my sense is you were talking about it within the complaints context. But my sense is that it's absolutely essential in therapy.
I absolutely agree. Prejudgment is Gadamer's term. It's exactly the same as presupposition, aware and unaware assumptions, preconceptions. And when I say that I think that misunderstanding is necessary to therapy, this misunderstanding that arises because my prejudgments and my client's prejudgments or preconceptions or unaware assumptions or whatever language you want to use don't match. Yeah? Thank you. And then it's there and then there.
I really enjoyed your talk. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And what I really like is the concept of rupture and repair, which you're talking about mistakes and therapy of the therapy. And so often get I guess, supervising is feel shamed and I made a mistake here. And to keep that in the relationship, I think is absolutely a brilliant way of relating, really. So I like the concept, that rupture and repair.
I have some difficulty sometimes with the word rupture.
Right.
Because I think that when we make mistakes, when we don't understand, what's nevertheless still true is our attempt to understand. And we wouldn't make that mistake in understanding if we weren't trying to understand.
Right.
So that's why I'm not quite happy with the word rupture, because the mistake, the misunderstanding, comes from a ground of the desire to understand, desire to... I think Robert Lee has done wonderful work on shame. I don't quite buy shame as a rupture of the field. Mm-hmm. As a rupture of the field. Awesome. Mm. Thank you. And then there was a question over there. You have to almost kiss it, it's horrible.
Oh, okay.
That's
I'm really curious how you brought in power at the beginning and then right at the very end, if I can be bold, say you brought in love and sort of like all the English and identified with that. And yet, your correspondence quote at the end, healing or the acceptance was depowering for me through the suggestion of compassionate love in two people being very vulnerable in the workplace. And I think if I take one thing away from this lecture, it's finding my original love for my client and not owning it as just my anxiety and the complaint, which is what I hold, but really power it up to be maybe the monster in the wardrobe without loving the person through, I'm creating a monster of the complaint as a separate entity rather than being open to love the client and myself through my own vulnerability in doing wrong or being wrong. And I think that that's a real gift you've given me there to take away. It's really newly qualified. I'm so afraid of this. It feels so opposite to so much that I've learned and want to bring to the profession that it's actually slightly, feels slightly disillusioned. What have I done that for then? I'm going to get told off at the end of it. So I know it came in at the beginning of it, but thank you very much for bringing the important side of the sandwich.
It shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be that any of us, but particularly our newest members, should go in fear of getting it wrong. And so I can't say strongly enough, misunderstandings are the way to understanding. And if we won't risk misunderstanding, we won't get to the understanding. The thing about power, I think that requires much more analysis. But one thing that's clear to me is that as a therapist or a counsellor, we have to deliberately, in that setting, withhold the frame. Within that, we make ourselves the less powerful. By that I mean, we question our assumptions. We don't require our clients to question their assumptions. That's where we start, until something more dialogical has emerged. Or,
yeah. There's something about humility in that, humility of the therapist.
Yeah.
And that if in the relationship you bring more of yourself, if you enter with fear as a therapist, then you're bringing that in the room to start with, and maybe the contact isn't as good because you're already bringing in stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you. There's one here and one here. Robin and Val.
I just want to bring in the unconscious processes out of awareness.
which you touched on, but of course, I mean, very, when we're aware of judgments and so on, that's fine. But it's when there's some unconscious processes going on that we're unaware of, and that's where the difficulty comes.
I used the unaware rather than unconscious, but I know what you mean, I think. But I think the point is that at the point where we find that we're not understanding, then we're not getting it in some way. That's the message to us. My unconscious or my unaware assumptions are swishing around here in some way.
I think probably, yes, I'm thinking to the extreme wrongdoing. Taking advantage sexually of those clients. And when I'm thinking about the field in that, I just wonder if there is more a sense of black and white.
I would still say I would see that as a field event. But that does not mean that that is what that person should have done. So if I say I see something as a field event, that's not the same as saying the client is to blame, or the client and the therapist shares some blame in that or some responsibility. They must have done it, the client has agreed to. But it's not to say, therefore, that the therapist somehow was the helpless victim of being a field. I think that bit of it, I need to work out more, or needs more working out. But yeah.
And also, the field is always present, so how can the field work? Because one of your correspondents seem to ignore the field.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I properly understood what they said. It's a telephone conversation, so it was impossible to debate with them much longer. And I was going to say something. I also have to say that I don't believe that any therapist or counsellor practicing today does not know that having sex with their client is viewed as not supporting their client's development. So whatever unconsciousness might be going on around it, I don't think consciously that they don't know what they're doing is viewed with great don't do it. Say it. That's a good word. Taboo, exactly. Thank you. Robin.
Hi. You mentioned the vulnerability of the therapist, and one of the questions I've been wondering around is about insurance, because from what I, from my perspective, what you're saying to the client, trust me, I'm a therapist. But I don't trust you on taking out insurance. So I've even gone just provocatively as far as to say that if you can choose your clients, I'm not talking about working in organisations, if you can choose your clients, and you're, to have insurance is unethical.
There's a really good test of that.
I can enjoy it.
I just wanted to put it forward in terms of how we defend against our own vulnerability.
Or, given that we're the best one in the world, we live in this dualistic world as well, we pay for our clients' insurance at the same time we pay for our own insurance. I'm not sure I did that.
You've misunderstood one another.
Oh, there you go. Now you see.
That's what it sounds like to me.
But I think what I'm getting at by throwing that in is the reality is that you're probably hundreds of times more likely to be in a motor accident than you are to be sued. And yet the suing is looming so large, it's become an energy of its own. And I just want throwing that in about the insurance. I just wanted to ruffle it all up a little.
There's one over here, and then one over there.
I was thinking about something which might seem a little obvious, and I don't think it's been mentioned, but there's something around if there's a misunderstanding that goes on. I'm a counsellor, so I work in private practice. What I notice sometimes really useful when something doesn't quite match is to apologise, and making apologies seems very important because it helps shift things when there is misunderstanding.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, I'm so sorry, I haven't got that. Oh, I got that wrong. And again, we shouldn't be afraid of apologising. We shouldn't fear that if I say, oh, I'm sorry, I got that wrong, that means, oh my God, here's the complaints procedure. Thank you.
I don't think this question is more of a sort of clarification or thing that I'm thinking about. I was struck by what you said about if there's someone to blame, that it's a safer position, in a way, it's clearer. And I think what you're getting at, my fear about that, is a kind of moral relativity that could, sort of a kind of argument for a certain kind of behaviour within a sort of relative way of understanding that. And I think what has helped me to be clearer about that is what you were saying about the idea of somehow ethics being intrinsic, that Darwin talked about so much as being social beings. Because I think that's the bit where I'm still a little bit confused, is how do you stop this idea of moral relativity, whereby you can argue for a certain kind of behaviour that may be easier to say that's wrong, this is right or wrong. That's sort of what I'm thinking. And the other thing that I want to say is that actually this is more difficult. That the field theoretical way seems more difficult and more arduous in a way, and takes more time. And sometimes it can feel much easier just to say, okay, that's it. There's a clarity in that, which may be how come the modernist view is very successful, because it's in a way easier to digest than to sometimes.
I'll tell you what comes to mind as I listen to you. One thing that comes to mind is something that Brian Goodwin says in Nature's Due. He's talking about scientists. He says something like moving away from the pre-modernist, reductionist view paradoxically creates a space for us to behave ethically. And I'm not sure I quite understood it, except I think he's referring, it's in the context of a sentence that starts with taking the picture of the whole. That's one thing that came up, that there's paradoxically we're released to behave more ethically. Now, I can certainly see that in terms of so much behaviour under the modernist paradigm I would consider to be immoral and unethical. Zero hours contracts, fracking, strip mining, all of those things are hardly, well, they're not ethical or moral. Certainly, it's not that taking a field view means that there aren't pervading or underlying ethical principles or ethical feelings, actually, not just principles. And both Darwin and, who did I say, Wheeler, argue for that. So I think it might be a straw, is it straw man? Is that the right phrase? I think it might be an accusation that is thrown in this direction as a defence against doing what's more difficult.
Moral relativity.
Yeah. It's almost a dirty word, moral relativity.
Okay, hang on a moment.
So, I mean, when I started thinking about this, I was thinking, the well, it was a year ago, and the stuff was going on even more that is still going on about Jimmy Savile and people like that. And I was thinking, well, okay, now do we say that actually at that time that was somehow more acceptable or not? And I thought, no, didn't make it any more acceptable. But I did think, what was my part in it? Now I was, I don't know, my teens, less than that. I'm not, all right, now let me really push what was my part in it. And what was my part in it is that, like many other girls, girl children, young women, we've been groped. We've been rubbed up against. We may not have been raped or done something that is more scary or more, but we've been groped. I've been groped. I never said anything about it. Why didn't I say something? Understandable reasons, it's so much shame in the field. I don't think my parents, I'm sure my parents would believe me, they wouldn't have dealt with me, but it was a shameful thing to talk about. But because I and others couldn't speak out, came to seem like it was an okay thing to do, an acceptable thing to do. It never was. So if I try that as a test of moral relativism, it doesn't work. Does that make sense? Over here?
I wanted to ask and say something about power, and you kind of reminded me when you were just referring to being groped when you were younger. I'm very aware that when my clients come to me, they invest me with some power. And I always find that quite difficult to deal with because I don't know what's going on most of the time. And the complaints procedure, at least the ones that are existent now, are dominated by issues of power. And I feel that if we don't address issues of power in our work as therapists, then and in a larger context as well, in a larger field, I think, which is what you might be encouraging, we're not actually doing our jobs, because our jobs seem to be very much about issues of power, or at least it is in my experience. And so for me, it's quite an interesting spectrum, power and vulnerability. And we deal with that all the time in our work.
You're not really asking a question, no. And I'm not going to attempt an answer. I'll say what comes to mind.
Yes.
I agree with you, is one thing. Some of the things that come to mind is I remember a long time ago, Tony Kuhnke talking about he's not from. And one of the things that apparently Isabel Froome said, and I think this is a very good thing, is that you don't invite your clients to do anything experimental until you're absolutely certain they can say no to you. That's one thing that came to mind. The other thing is that it's our job, yes, our clients do, they put their hope in us. And sometimes that hope can be expressed in very unobvious ways, like they might come in as though they think we're the worst therapist in the world and they don't really know why they come to see us, but they do put their hope in us. And that is a hope for connection and a hope for understanding. And I think if we resist from the word go, the temptation to be more knowing, that helps. I mean, there are other influences in the field that make the relationship skewed, not least of which is they're paying us and we're insuring ourselves. So, but if we are meticulous about declining the investment of their power in us, which means declining any belief that we know them better than they know themselves, declining any wish to be the expert, except as far as a clarifications expert is. We do something about that. And the third thing, of course, that came to mind is, well, many of you would have heard this, Carl Hodges will frequently say, vulnerability expressed is leadership. Vulnerability expressed is very powerful, in the better sense of the word. Hi.
I'm not on commission with the book stall, but I did buy it, and I caught it just this morning, and this just seems so brilliant. This is Jerry Hughes, Can Competence Be Defined? Competence is contextual. A practitioner may be competent with a particular client in a particular situation and not competent in another. It can change from moment to moment as we negotiate the demands of client work. Because counsellors and psychotherapists are human beings, we are subject to limitations. This brings vulnerability, but it is also our greatest strength. We could not meet our clients in their vulnerability if we were not acquainted with that. Thank you.
It reminds me of Frank Stamer as well, Cultivated Uncertainty. We need to deliberately cultivate not knowing. Oh, there's a hand up over there.
I want to go back to the beginning of your talk when you were talking about personal responsibility for taking on, changing the world view, pushing our agenda. Because I think it's incredibly difficult. I find it very difficult. What's come up for me during this talk has been the time about 20 years ago when I worked in the NHS. And I was working seeing individuals in the staff team. That was my job. And I ended up with several individuals on one team because I was having to keep confidentiality. And they had been scapegoated, blamed, this culture that we're talking about, this dualistic view of things, for something that happened very strongly. And I was wondering what would happen. Who would be the next one after they got rid of the one? And what happened is it was me. I got complained about. And because I knew about the NHS, and what I see is a huge juggernaut, and that's often what you're up against in some circumstances, I was offered the chance to just go and the complaint not being made formal, and I took that opportunity. I did not confront the situation. I'd seen too many people as staff doing staff counselling who were really stressed out, exhausted against the big, huge system, one individual trying to thwart it. It was being really difficult. So I didn't choose that route. Instead, I wrote a good report on what had happened to my supervisor, who instead had not supported me. But who I thought I wanted to, so I spread the word in court. And I found out later, some years later, it had been taken up and listened to. So I just want to speak for the sort of vulnerability of trying to actually hold to these principles sometimes. I don't really have any other questions, but it is very complicated. When you get involved in these situations, how do you deal with them?
Thank you. We cannot act alone. We cannot act alone. I was at a conference a few weeks ago, and Lynn O'Shea was talking about diversity And she used the phrase, which I want to borrow, dense, diverse, dependable communities. Dealing with, she was talking about diversity, marginalization, difference, but in dealing with, well, anything really, we need dense, diverse, dependable communities. I don't know enough about the IPN network and the practitioner network. I know that the practitioners work as a group. I don't know how complaints process works with that, but it seems to me that that's, well, it's an example of a dense, dependable community. I'm not sure how diverse it might be, but certainly a dense, dependable community. Yeah. No, we can't.
And it's very it's very different from the institutional frameworks of BACP or UKCP, because they are ultimately become faceless.
Yeah.
But there's no dialogue with them at a personal relational level at all.
Yes, and I have to say, when I phoned up UKCP, I got straight through to Sultana Kunam, I think her name is, who's the complaints manager. And she was open and informative and very willing to dialogue with me. So hopefully this, it's interesting that both UKCP and BACP are reviewing their complaints procedures and their codes of practice. They should be business. Okay, how are you doing? Any more questions? Are you ready to break for lunch?
I have a comment rather than a question.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the your respondent that you didn't quite understand what they meant. But I'm thinking of myself going into a psychotherapy situation as a novice, and I have an understanding of when the shit hits the fan out in the world, that there is some sort of professional process that will deal with that. And therefore, what I took them to mean is that it is reasonable for that person going into the situation to have a recognizable system to protect them in the situation. And therefore, what I'm trying to, I think in many, many respects, we're talking about really good practice. You know, we make mistakes all the time, we repair them. Sometimes that's very difficult, we get loads of support for it. It's a very, very small minority of times when that doesn't happen, and what do we do? I would suggest that maybe to expect a client to go into a process which they won't have the same understanding, presumably, as somebody struggle with this sort of donkey's ears like many of us have, to expect them to go to a process where they may appear to be taking on someone for blame, I think is a big ask.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And two or three things came up. I think that Julia's thing about moral relativism, I think that might have been what my correspondent was concerned about, that actually what I'm advocating is somehow relativistic and
it's related.
Yes. That was one thing I thought. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be complaints procedures, I'm saying we should try and do them differently. And I think that in moving closer and mobilising the field, that field has to mobilise for the client, not just for the therapist. So that we pull in the supports, maybe from clients who are ex-clients or maybe from therapists who are going to in some way stand with the client so that I'm not just talking about that relationship with the therapist. And the third thing I thought that you said was very few complaints are accepted as within the framework. There's a large number, but still not a very large number, that go to the initial conversation about. And then there's a larger number, and still not a huge number, that go to a kind of a more, if I were talking about complaints, sort of thing. So it's, now, I wonder, I was speaking to somebody about the small amount, a serious one, when I had this conversation with UKCP, what am I talking about? It's only 0.4%. The person I was talking to said, well, that seems like things something's working. I said, well, maybe or maybe not. Maybe what's happening is that a lot of people are leaving therapy because of misunderstandings. And as I say, the misunderstanding will be the crux of the therapy, probably. But a lot of people are leaving therapy because of misunderstandings. Before ever the misunderstanding gets so difficult or so entrenched that it begins to become an issue for where the person begins to think in terms of taking a complaint. So that if we change our way of thinking about misunderstandings, I suppose, and mistakes, even if that doesn't mean that we've got to, well, I know, but it means we have different. Yeah, I'll start that sentence again. I think we need to have a different complaints procedure and process so that people are not working in fear. And therefore, that they can more comfortably be fallible, because that's what our clients require of us, our fallibility, in terms of meeting misunderstandings and resolving understandings. That's a clear way to say. Thank you. Okay, you listened very patiently. Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you for a really stimulating, exciting.
Is that right?
Yes.
Just wonderful, and a lot to think about. And we look forward to being able to do that this afternoon. So first of all, an interim, very big thank you.